Let's drop the green flag on this episode of the Talent Tank Podcast with your host, Wyatt Pemberton, bringing you the best, fastest, most knowledgeable personalities in Ultra 4 and off-road racing.
All right. Welcome back. We've got the Talent Tank. We're here to fill it up. We've got a, we got an amazing individual looking back at me on the screen today that you guys are going to get your ears filled with. We've got Mr. Phil Licardi. Shock Jesus.
Hey there. How are y'all? Phil. I don't expect a response.
Right. Because you can't hear them yelling at their screen going, damn it.
Get this guy out of here.
Man, so you guys are kind of in for it. Before I kind of roll into it too far, man, Phil and I have, we've jumped through some hoops to make this happen. Technology has not been on our side at all. We've got between Phil's laptop and Skype and then the recording on my end. So here's what we're doing. We've got Phil on Skype looking at me looking at him on Skype, but we're muted, fully muted. But then he's on his cell phone with his Apple earbuds in, and we're talking to each other on his cell phone to my cell phone, which who knows? I've got one bar of signal on that thing. We'll see even how good that is. I'm not confident in the audio. The audio is definitely not going to be up to a normal par, but I think the content's going to be worth it, right?
This is what makes it fun, you know? you could do it perfect and then it would probably just be boring, but let's make it weird.
Yeah. Well, this is one of those situations where it's like, no matter how much prep you do in the world, when you pull up to the green flag to go, one wheel falls off.
Right. Oh man. I'll tell you, when you sent me that questionnaire and all this prep work, I was like, well, this is serious, but you're mailing me stuff to do things with. And then hours ago, I set it up. I was like, oh my God, there's even a picture of me on the online. So I figured we were good to go. And then sure enough, not quite. Now it's like we're watching a movie where, you know, the mouths are moving at the wrong speed for the sound coming out. But it'll make things entertaining for sure.
It's a piece of work. Anyway, well, hey, guys. So like I said, we've got Phil Licardi on here today. He runs a business called Liberty Mountain Fab in Gardnerville, Nevada, which is kind of in the Reno, Tahoe area. Clearly on the Nevada side, not the California side. He is a former Californian. He escaped. Yeah. When did you get out of there? 2013?
2014. We've been here for 6 years and a few months now.
There you go. See, amazing. You guys might know him online because he's a character and he's been around rock sports for a billion years. I've known him from Pirates since about 2004, but he goes by, you know, recent names like Shock Jesus. But back in the Pirate 4x4 days, he was known as Silly Neck. It's an old school name there. And we'll get into how that all came to fruition and how he got that name. He's also known as the Searcher of Doug's Axles.
Haven't found those yet. We got different ones, but old Jim's hanging tight onto those torque units.
Yeah, the axle quests. You go out on an axle quest and you don't find axles. You're one of the rock zombies.
I am.
What would you call the rock zombies exactly? We're going to get into them here in a little bit, but they are definitely a rock crawling, rock sports racing club these days that puts on a badass car wash. But more stuff. Yes. And I've known a lot of rock zombies over the years. I mean, like Travis Carpenter. I mean, I love that guy. And
totally.
Yeah, I mean, you guys have had just some amazing individuals roll through there. And then also, if you follow Phil online, he's a political pundit. He's very to the right. He's kind of a patriot, you know, sticking up for freedoms. Do you see yourself any portion? I think a part of me following you is you're a little libertarian.
I just want to be left alone, honestly. Let me make my money. Let me have my stuff. Let me have my off-road. That's my biggest thing, man. Is every time we get a commie, you know, running the show, we're just losing a little bit of our freedom all the time. Granted, you know, Trump hasn't been the total be all end all of freedom, but I feel like I haven't lost one trail or seen a bunch of BLM types running around putting up signs and gates since he's been in office either. So that was definitely a thing during Obama's years.
Since you moved up to Gardnerville, where in California were you at? You were a SoCal guy?
No, I was just the other side of the hill from here. Sacramento area.
Folsom.
Yeah, I was in Citrus Heights. You know, we had a nice little neighborhood out there. And then my shop was in Gold River, which is Rancho Cordova, almost Folsom.
I got you. And then 6 years ago, you bailed to the other side of the El Dorado Forest, went down the grade, and made a new home.
You got it, man. Man, it's been amazing over here. Amazing. We're ready to go further now, but I love it here.
And kind of your current, you know, involvement and claim to fame, I alluded to it, your nickname, Shock Jesus. You're kind of the guy who, you know, the purveyor of the smooth ride.
Sometimes. I don't know. It's the Shock Jesus thing. That's definitely not, I won't claim that. I won't own that. That's, you know, I'd rather be a whole lot more humble than that. Let's just say I'm better than having no shock tuner.
You set the bar so low, but I know there's so many people that totally, you know, sing your praises.
You know, I've had tons and tons of great results. And like everyone else, I've had vehicles that just fight me, whether it's because the design or something I'm missing. And, you know, I'm still new to this. We got guys that have been shock tuning since they were little kids. And I wish I would have picked it up 10 years earlier, but that just, it didn't become a reality until I moved here, because I can tune right out of my yard here. Before, I'd have to load up and go to Prairie City, and then I didn't have a mobile setup. So I'd have to go back to the shop, take shocks apart poorly, put them back together full air, not know the difference, and then go back out and test again. And it was wrong. And then you just wasted the whole day screwing around. Now it's like, boom, test, come back, make a change, go back out. I don't have to, you know, it doesn't take all day to do it anymore.
Yeah. I mean, that was one of the things I learned from like Wayne Israelson, was that's what his key was, getting the mobile unit. Once he got the trailer, he was going to Barstow, he was going to Parker, he was going to Plaster City and helping guys get their junk together. But even him, he didn't start tuning, you know, because Ultra Fours tuning and Ultra Fours really didn't become a thing until 2009.
Right. Yeah. I think we tuned with him in 2011, and you know, he had a lot of people out there. It was a big day. The wind was terrible. We didn't get to do nearly as much as we would have liked to have done. I was just like, wow, this is a hard, hard thing. And then I also was like, there's a huge hole in this industry that could use a little bit of filling. So
yeah, right.
So I did the best I could to try and cover a different territory. I never thought I'd pick up all this East Coast stuff. I just was like, oh, I can just, you know, take care of all my local guys up here that want to go wheeling on the trails and a couple of racers and whatever. And then I don't even know what the hell happened. Now I don't have any free time and life is miserable. But it's, you know, it's awesome, man. It's awesome at the same time.
It is something. Yeah. So let's talk about, before we kind of get into your life and all, and well, not just your life and what you're doing with Liberty Mountain Fab and all the shock tuning stuff. Let's talk current affairs really quick and kind of deep dive on that. Where you live in Gardnerville, and, you know, being on the West Coast, you know, half, you know, three quarters of the country is kind of, you know, turned and looking at you guys for everything out around you is on fire. And you just had a, yeah, you're laughing, but you just had a, you and your wife, you guys just had a very, very, very near miss. Walk us through that. In your life flashing before your eyes and all that went on. This was what, 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago now?
Shoot, man. We're getting on 2 months, I think. I think it was right around July 4th when it happened.
Are you serious?
Right, maybe July. I think it was July 5th it happened, right? That sounds about right.
Time stood here. Still for me here in the, you know, like the last month. So I do know it was months. I will definitely say, if you say July 5th, I'm going to take your word for it. So that's
it might 2 months be. Ago. I don't know. Life's a blur. I drink a lot. You know, who knows?
Fair enough.
Yeah. Anything specific, or you want me to just run down the whole show?
No, man, you could roll around down the whole show. I think what I saw online was, you guys got the, you know, they showed up or someone gave you notice, get out of there. And then from there, you guys escaped with like a skid steer, the clothes on your back and your dogs. And then luckily you have a bunch of security cameras and you got to see, the local smoke eaters or whoever came in from wherever they came in from, basically work through the early morning hours from like midnight to 7 a.m. just saving your place.
Right. So obviously a lot of people know Dan Wyrick. He's another racer. He's got a UFO car, really good friend of mine. He was out doing some golfing in the area and they were, I think we were having some whiskey or something before this all went down. And then he was leaving with his trailer to go up to the next golf situation or something. I hit the couch. It's like 7 o'clock, I think. And he calls me. He's like, dude, get out here. I was like, F you, man. I'm on the couch. We're not doing any of that crap. He's like, no, get out here now. I'm like, okay, obviously this is serious. So I put my boots on, go outside, and I see the black column of smoke. I'm like, oh shit. And it's not 200 yards away. I'm like, dude, this is happening right now. And the wind usually blows to the south or to the east. And today it was blowing to the north, which is where we were. Said, oh shit. Okay. So I jumped on the skid steer, ran up as fast as I could to the neighbor's house, opened their gate and started cutting a fire break as fast as I could. And I don't think I was on that thing for 6 bucket widths before it overran me. And I said, well, guess we're done doing that. The neighbors were trying to keep their propane tank cool. And then we're like, well, we're going to abort this whole thing. Took off, came back here and started packing stuff up and to get out of here. We had people showing up that I didn't call, coming with trailers and pulling vehicles out of here. Sarah's grabbing like birth certificates and the dogs and whatever. And she rolled out. And then I grabbed, you know, cash and some firearms and then pushed the buggy onto the trailer because my sweet Optima battery was dead again. So
that wasn't a plug.
Yeah, that was the opposite. So hopefully you're not sponsored by them because they are assholes. Ended up killing one of my Trapador tires. And here's a plug. Scott Goforth sent me a brand new 40-inch sticky Trapador because I killed that one. And I wasn't in a position to where I was in, you know, I was in bad shape, man. We didn't lose anything. And he's still, I was like, dude, don't charge me for it. I don't need, he's like, nope. I might need a favor from you at some point. So you're going to take that tire. I said, all right, you're the man. And I bought a bunch of tires from recently. So solid dude for sure.
We like to take care of those that take care of us.
I do appreciate it. So we got out when we were leaving. I don't know. Some people have seen pictures of my house, my property, whatever. So there's a container at the back corner of my shop where my race trailer with my entire livelihood sits. The fire was like at the container on the mountain when we were leaving. The front of the property is totally fire prepped. The back of the property is a mountain. No matter what picture you look at, it looks like it's a flat ground, but it's not vertical, but it's not. I mean, you ain't just driving up there in a skid steer or something. You know, it's some work to clear that. So I hadn't done it. So that's what was burning. There weren't any units down here or anything when we left. I'm just like, well, we lost our house. It's gone. Hopefully the shop doesn't burn with all the race cars and shit in it. But luckily they had a couple of units on that thing all night. They just kept the house cool while everything burned around it. And not a thing happened to the shop. There's no smoke damage to the house. The only thing that got hurt is the looks of the mountain behind the house. So, you know, no big deal. And I got a day off out of it. So that was pretty sweet.
Well, now you know, all that tinder box that was, you know, up the hill behind you is now gone. It got utilized.
Yeah. Long as it doesn't mudslide this winter, we're looking pretty good.
Yeah, that is some concern. So, yeah. So then the rest of the state's burning and you're kind of okay.
Yeah. And, you know, it was going to be like, you know, our local law enforcement guys, most of the dudes I'm pretty good friends with, and they're days into this investigation. They're like, it's ours and this, it's ours and that, blah, blah, blah. We got all this stuff sorted out. And then BLM comes strolling in. They're like, it was a semi-truck diesel particulate filter apart. And nothing to see here. Please be on your way. And I was pissed at first, but it turns out that, you know, they've been building a case against the arsonists and they've been picking up arsonists damn near daily that have been most of these fires. Granted, lightning has done some work too, but it's mostly arson.
Yeah. That's the sick and disgusting part about it that we've seen is that it has been arsonist and they've picked up a ton of them and then we're still having to listen to the talking heads and the, you know, the alphabet media saying things along the lines of, you know, climate change, and global warming, and it wasn't forestry mismanagement. It wasn't, you know, again, arsonist, no nefarious. None of this was nefarious. This is all of us in our gas guzzlers and, you know, burning fuel and, you know, cow farts and what it
right. Yeah. Doesn't make you, I mean, they want civil war. Okay. You want it. Let's do it.
Terrible. Well, you know, but that all said, I'm glad, you know, you guys were blessed to have some fire crews that absolutely were, you know, saints. They really, really, you know, walk on burning fire to save your property. I think those guys, kudos to those guys, the smoke eaters. This time of year, that's all they're doing is, you know, sleeping on the ground, you know, sleeping on the hard ground, a couple hours here, a couple hours there, and then just killing it the rest of the time. And those guys are badass heroes.
Right. I'll give another shout out to one more guy who might actually hear this because he's in the industry. It's Brody Zink. A lot of people seen him because he's got a wagon here on 40s, and it's like a yellowish, whitish, woodish, and he's been in some magazines and whatnot. Super cool dude, and he is a hot shot. He was marching around that mountain for days after it happened, putting out fires, and you know, he was taking pictures and sending them to me that night. He's like, "I think you're okay, dude." And you know, a bunch of my other friends were saying that too, which was just super cool. Super cool that we could kind of know what was going on when no one else was knowing what was going on.
Yeah, you know, now that this comes out, this is actually my memory of this, you know, flashing back to this. I remember waking up the next morning, and the nice thing about the Talent Tank and the Insiders Group and, you know, how far the reach in Ultra 4 is, I know, you know, I don't have a responsibility, but I do. I feel like I have a responsibility. I put out what did we do? It was was it a PayPal? It was just sending PayPals to Sarah. I can't remember
how. I think you guys did a PayPal, and I think someone fired up a GoFundMe, and I was like, oh man, I mean, that was huge. Huge.
It felt like it went off like wildfire, but then, you guys got up, you got around, the house ended up being okay, and every single dollar went right back to everybody, and you're like, thanks, but no thanks. We got it.
And I'm wondering, one person wouldn't take the money back, and I'd have to ask Sarah who it was, and they said, just pass it on to, and maybe it was even you that said, pass it on to somebody else who wasn't as fortunate, and that did get passed on. There was a family that lost everything on the other side of the hill. And the reason why they lost everything is because they were helping a neighbor save everything. So they were, I mean, I don't think their GoFundMe went as hard as it could, but you know, we gave everything we could to them, you know, in addition to what was passed on to us. And, you know, it's just the most unfortunate thing. I think in our whole 18,000 acre fire, man, I think only 4 housing structures actually burned that we know of. There's a lot of Indian land out there that's all gated off and everything, and no one might ever know what happened out there, but you know, that we know of, you know, a lot of outbuildings died, but not too many main structures.
Well, I'm glad you guys came out okay, and we'll talk about your wife Sarah here in a little bit and figure out how you got so lucky.
Yeah, right.
Growing up in Citrus Heights, mom, dad, clearly,
you know, I didn't grow up there. I grew up in Massachusetts. I only lived in Citrus Heights with my wife.
Oh, okay.
I don't know if maybe I didn't have that noted in there, but
You did not. You didn't note a damn thing. I knew you're from California and then you moved, but that was only from my memory from way back.
Oh,
you know, way back when. So I was, you know, I'm totally going off memory on that part. But so okay, so you're from Massachusetts. Let's go into that. Everyone would like to hear that you followed in the footsteps of the Dave Cole going from the East Coast or Shannon Welsh going from East Coast, going to California.
Right.
Growing up in Massachusetts, tell us about that.
So honestly, where I grew up in Massachusetts was called Plainville. And it was, the reason I moved to Gardnerville is because it reminded me so much of how Plainville was when I was a kid. It's not like that anymore. It's a total city. In that area, everything's built, developed, and you can't do anything. But back when I was a kid, you could ride your dirt bike to school. You could ride your dirt bike to the store. You could do whatever you want. In the winter, there's people ripping up and down the street on snowmobiles. I mean, there wasn't a lot of law enforcement to mess with you back then. It was just an absolute ball. And we grew up on a little bit of land, and we had tons of, I wouldn't call it public land because that wasn't really a thing, but there was tons of vacant land that we could go do whatever we wanted to on, and which was pretty much off-road anything. It was honestly just great. And that's what drew me to my area now. I don't know if you have another question in the middle.
Well, yeah, absolutely. Was there any sports you were into at that point? And when did you get into, you were into dirt bikes way back then.
You know, the only sport I was into was dirt bikes. I was forced to play a lot of sports. My parents are quite a bit fancier than I am. And they forced me to play tennis. And I was really, really good at it. And I just wanted to see the other kids that weren't good at other stuff cry. So I just beat the living crap out of them at that sport. Won a lot of tournaments. did what I had to do so I was able to ride dirt bikes. It was miserable. I played soccer. I played baseball. Soccer was all right. I didn't much care for baseball. Hated tennis.
This is cracking me up because Ryan Miller was this past week's, Talent Tank episode, and he was also a tennis player. And yeah, I never saw that coming.
I don't think we wanted to, I don't know about him, but I didn't want to be. I didn't want anything to do with that, man. I was like, what am I wearing right now? This is ridiculous.
So did you end up deciding what was the point, and what was, for some of those listening, the inflection point now, what was the point where you decided you were going to end up going to California, and how did you settle on where you end up in California?
There's a step in the middle. My dad worked for a big company in Massachusetts that did blood work testing, this, that, and the other, and they were bought out by another huge company who paid my dad to not work for 2 years, basically not work for a competitor for 2 years. When that 2 years was up, instead of retiring or hanging out, even on my mom's, 10-year teaching salary, we could have just stayed there. He decided that we were going to move on to something else. So he found a really cool gig in his eyes with Guardsmark Incorporated. And that was in Memphis, Tennessee. So we lived there for a couple of years. And Guardsmark, if you've ever seen the movie The Firm, that was based on this guy, the owner of that company, who was a paranoid schizophrenic. And it just got really weird. Everything got really weird. So we were out of Memphis in a couple of years without going into any potentially legal details on that. And then a couple of guys my dad worked with in Massachusetts started a company in California. And that's how the long and short of how we ended up in California.
Okay, very cool. Now, so as you made your way through high school, you did go to college for a while.
I did.
But you didn't finish.
I did not, no.
No, I knew you didn't finish. But what cracked me up as I'm reading this, you are like 12, you're a semester shy of graduating with a degree in philosophy.
Yeah, I thought that would be funny if I had a degree. I really wanted a doctorate in philosophy, because I was like, well, I'd be a Dr. Phil with a doctorate in Phil. And I was drunk the entire time I was in Chico. So pretty much whatever was funny was what I was doing. And then obviously that came to a screeching halt.
And you bounced out. So when in there did you start getting into street bikes? Was that it was a byproduct of being a dirt bike guy? What was the point where you started picking up riding on the street?
It's a good question. I don't know what started it. I had a street legal two stroke KTM 360, which, anybody that's into dirt bikes, when you can get a street legal two stroke, that's not the most comfortable thing to ride on the road, but it sure is cool. And I had that and I was like, this is pretty cool. And then I don't know, I probably saw a YouTube video, if YouTube even existed. I probably just saw something online back in the day and I was like, what are these guys doing with these huge motorcycles? Something sparked that. And I was like, you know what? I'm going to get one of those. So I found a totaled 02 Gixxer 750 Suzuki and kind of fixed that thing up and started riding. And then one thing led to another. Wheelies are cool. Chicks dig wheelies. Here we are today.
And you were just you were a stunner. And I remember, that's what I remembered about you from the Pirate 4x4 days was, wheelies, stoppies, everything. You were always posting either videos or, like magazine cover shots of you on the cover of how many magazine covers did you do?
I think I only did one magazine cover.
But multiple stories, multiple coverage. Back when print media was a thing, right?
It was, man. And that was so much fun to be able to get your hands on that stuff. And we still got a few things posted on the wall here, I just walk by it every day. I don't really give it much thought, but yeah, that was really fun back then, man. It was a ball. A lot of videos. I was in a lot, no movies. I never did the whole Screen Actors Guild thing, but I was in a ton of videos. And that was just loads of fun.
Were you guys doing shows? Were you did you make it to the point where you were traveling doing shows?
Yeah, there was a couple of years there. So I stopped going to school probably in 2003, and I'd already got the bike and I'd been riding quite a bit. And then I think my first competition was 04. I went all the way to Stunt Wars in Florida. I was in Chico, California. We went all the way to Lakeland, California for that. And if you ever see anything on TV about Lakeland, California or whatever, I don't know what county that is. That's Polk County or what that is. But you'll see that the sheriff's department is, and just the police presence there is absolutely huge now. And I would say that was from 03 to 07 Stunt Wars that caused that. Because everyone's been to parties, everyone's been to hammers, you know, stuff gets a little wild, yada, yada, yada. You know, it never gets as wild as somebody with a 50cc dirt bike up on top of the Hooters hotel and restaurant launching that motorcycle into the pool at midnight. It never gets that crazy with thousands of people around. It was just that was the most wild scene I'd ever been in my life. It was nuts.
But you got to experience it though. And you lived a lot.
I wouldn't take those years back for anything. That was a ball for sure.
So at what point did you end up meeting your wife, Sarah?
So I met her July 5th, 2006.
Was that kind of the end of the stunting?
Yeah. Yeah, that was, and it wasn't because she wanted me to stop. It was because I was aware of what that scene was all about, and it was full of, let's call it temptation. Not drugs by any means, but there's plenty of ladies readily available, ready to ruin your relationship. So I knew what was going to happen, and I immediately bailed out of that whole scene. I think I did a couple more shows, and I just shut it down at that point. I was like, this is the woman I'm going to marry, and I need to get my shit together.
And I'm going to get off a little bit of a tangent here. Somewhere in there, you started fabricating. You started fabbing back then, right?
I started fabricating in 99, maybe 98. Yeah, even out of my parents' garage back before I went to college.
I think you started, is that about the time that you started fabricating like for a living around that, like into street biking, or was that just a ways to a means?
The street bike stuff was just, I don't know if you'd call it killing time or what it was. I mean, it made decent money from time to time, but I was always fabricating. I mean, I'd be home. When I started traveling for stunt riding, I'd be home a week, a month probably. And I'd just knock out a couple jobs and get a few bucks to go down the road, pay my rent, pay my shop rent, and head on down the road again.
What was the genesis behind your pirate screen name back then?
That was a good one. Back before that happened. So I guess we would have been gearing up to start my senior year of high school, and that would have been end of 98. I was into downhill mountain biking too a little bit, and we were at this place called North Star, which was a place, you know, it's a ski resort, but in the summertime it's downhill mountain biking. I was going down this trail at a high rate of speed, being an idiot as usual. It usually worked out for me except for this time. And they, for whatever reason, they had, like, you know what snow netting looks like, that orange snow netting?
Yeah. Snow fence.
Yeah. Imagine that as a tape. So it's just a single strand of squares. And then they've got it on this PVC pipe, and it's slid over rebar, and it's all the way across the bottom of this trail. And I don't know how you're supposed to go down the face of this trail under 50 miles per hour. Well, the snow fence tape was kind of like funneling you off to this little side chute that if you entered that at 15 miles per hour, you're doing superhero stuff. So I come down this thing going Mach whatever, no signs above. There's nothing telling me that this was going to happen when I got down there. And I immediately got clotheslined by that stuff. And I did a full gainer onto my stomach, couldn't breathe for a little while. And life was not ideal at the moment. Senior year was starting that Monday. Yeah, I went into senior year with like these purple squares with like white centers all around my neck. You know, you got that, you got the Jerky Boys, the rest is history. And there we have it.
Silly neck. All right. Yeah. Well, but you didn't break your neck.
I might have. I don't know. I never got checked. I broke it a lot since then.
I do recall, it wasn't even that many years ago you broke it.
Yeah, 2013. Yep.
What'd you do there? I should remember the story, but I don't.
I was a big Dune transfer at Sand Mountain, and came off the face super hot and chose not to kill one of my spotters on the landing. So I kind of tracked out in the air and put me on the wrong side of a razorback. Like I had a nice rolled landing to the right or a razorback to the left. And I chose left because the right might've put me out in the rocks or killed the dude. Couldn't get my front tire over the, I was like 9 feet away from getting my front tire over the razorback, which might've been a different story we're talking about right now if that went like that. And then I ended up bouncing out into the flats, got paralyzed and broke 9 vertebrae and damaged the shit out of a lung. Oh, it was just, it was not a cool day. I'll tell you that.
What a, I just have to laugh. You can't do anything but laugh when you look back at that and laugh at that, because you're still here today from it.
Still here, still walking. I mean, that I didn't get knocked out or anything. I was legit paralyzed for a few minutes. And I was like, well, go get my gun. I'm like, someone else is going to have to pull the trigger. This ain't going to work. And then no one went and got my gun. But my legs started working first. And I was like, okay, I know how this works. If my legs start working, my arms are going to start working. And I started getting feeling in my arms. And I actually, after everything started kind of working again, I actually rode my dirt bike back to camp. Oh. I couldn't, like, yeah, someone was trying to put me in the sand rail. Like, they're like, oh, we'll give you a ride. I'm like, dude, I can't bend like that. It's like, somebody start my bike and help me on it. I'll get back to camp. I got back to camp, sat in a chair for a minute. And I was like, ooh, this is the most hurt I've ever been. This isn't okay. And shortly thereafter, Sarah took me up to the hospital, where I went into the hospital under my own power. Pretty proud of that, because they didn't believe how bad I was. And then they took x-rays. And then they're like, oh, this dude's not okay. So they life flighted me to Reno after giving me some morphine. And then, yeah, then I got fixed up kind of.
How close were you to being truly permanently paralyzed? Close?
I mean, it could have gone either way, man. I crashed a few weeks earlier at a track called MMX. I had some 16-year-old type punk wanted to show the old man what's up on the track, and he ended up crashing in front of me, which took me out pretty bad. I broke C4 and C5 in my neck and a rib, and probably did some other permanent damage I don't know about. I didn't go to the hospital for that one either. I just kind of fought through it, worked, did my thing, and then went to Sand Mountain when I was feeling better. So I found out C4 and C5 were broken, so I had degenerative bone disease in my neck there. That's where I got my stinger. And then they just told me when they did all my x-rays and CAT scans and MRIs in Reno that's what had happened. So hot mess. I try not to be as dumb now.
Well, are you 40 yet? Or have you had your 40th birthday?
I haven't. That's next March. I'm 39 right now.
You're already, you know, a walking cripple, right?
Yeah. I don't move so good anymore. It's depressing. Sometimes some days are better than others. I mean, the reason why I move at all is because of Cairo Sport in Auburn. My buddy, Dr. Glenn Jeffrey Barney, he put me back together the first time. I haven't had any surgery or anything, nothing. I'm actually pretty good for my situation.
Wow. No, that's super impressive. So back to Sarah and, you know, getting married and all that stuff. And you guys have been together for, you know, 14 years, 15 years, somewhere in there.
Yes, sir. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And then how long have you guys actually been married though?
We've been married since 2008. There you go. So we got married April 19th. Yeah. Yeah. We just had our 12th wedding anniversary this April.
Congratulations.
Appreciate that. Yeah. I guess that's a rare thing these days.
It actually kind of is. My wife and I we're at 15. I think we've been together for 18, I think is what she was telling me. I have to listen to her. She has to tell me. I remember some dates. Like I remember like our wedding date is, you know, the day after tax day. So I know right. April pay taxes, then I have to do an anniversary. I get it. You know, we're good. We're good. So, but was Sarah into off-road stuff, or did you have to convert her, or how did you meet this lady that, you way out kicked your punt coverage? I mean, when I see her online, her presence, what she has to say, she's very outspoken. She's political as well. Well-spoken at that. And then you actually see pictures of her and you're like, Man, Phil, I mean, not that you're not like a good looking dude. You're a pretty good looking dude, but she's hot.
Well, you're looking at me right now. You see my current situation. Things are not ideal.
No, you actually look like shit.
You're right, dude. I feel like I've been run over by a bus.
Your hair is extra special. But that doesn't mean that your wife isn't, you know, always put together.
I married way out of my league. She found me on MySpace and stalked me. And then I caught her outside of my house taking pictures. No, that didn't happen. But she definitely found me on MySpace, sent me a message. And I was like, oh, my God, who's this lady that wants to meet me? And we had a bunch of mutual friends. And it's funny because now we recount all the different times, all the different parties over the years that we might have crossed paths, might have met. I don't know that the stars would align. Like she was in a long-term relationship before me with a drag race guy. On paper, he looks cool. But he's not that cool of a guy. So not as cool as me because I won.
Right. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. So it's good that we didn't meet at the other times because we were both in different places in life. And I mean, I settled down because of her. I don't think I was planning on settling down. She probably saved my life, I'd say. I don't think I'd be face down in a gutter of my own urine at this point.
It's funny how that works though, right? Completely funny how that works. Yeah. So you guys, you know, outside of, you know, outside activities, I think you had another commonality with Ryan Miller and it was, you guys like, I mean, or is this just a Arizona, Nevada thing where you guys like hunting ghost towns, old mining towns?
You know, have you ever done it?
No. I'm in Texas and I'm on the Gulf Coast. We have nothing. There's nothing old around here. Well, I mean, kind of, I live on where I live is an old plantation. So we do have some there is some older buildings where they would render the sugar cane because I live near, you know, the area of Texas I live in, you know, there was a lot of sugar plantations. That's what they were. And they would render the cane into sugar, but it was slaves. I mean, it was slaves. So this is the PC version, the politically correct BS world we're living in. It seems crazy. Everyone is, you know, snowflake, whatever this is. My neighborhood was called and has been called since it was developed Sienna Plantation.
Oh, wow.
They dropped the plantation 4 or 5 months ago. So
we're Sienna. Man.
We're just plantation.
It happens so quick. Like the changes we're seeing happen so darn quick. It's just crazy. I don't know. But I mean, that everything's got its history, man. I mean, I'm sure there's all kinds of stuff that, well, at least used to be in that area that was worth checking out. But I mean, for us, nothing decays quickly here. There's no moisture. So things, if you build something and people don't destroy it, it might last for centuries. I don't really know. But we go, I don't know. I think the coolest thing about Nevada is most ghost towns have a bar that's still open. So we're going to drive on some dirt to this bar and then not really break laws on the way back as a result. I don't know. I don't know. I just like driving fast on the dirt and with my friends. And if we have a good time on the way there and back, hey, that's always a good time.
So then there's hot springs up in that area?
Everywhere. Yeah. It's probably because there's like nuclear waste in the ground or something. But yeah, there's all kinds of hot springs. There's some that are just a few minutes behind our house that we frequent quite often.
What's the temperature on them? Is it like 120 or 100 or 90 or?
You know, they vary, but the ones that are nearest us that we're at most often are pleasant. They're miserable in the summer. You're not going to go out there when it's 80 degrees. In the winter, if it's snowing or 30, 40 degrees, whatever, they're probably like 102, 103, like just perfect hot tub temperature. Oh, you can regulate them. Yeah, you can. You know, the water probably would like to come out quite a bit hotter, but the way most of those are set up, I mean, you can bleed them off or bring in creek water or whatever and regulate the temp. It's pretty cool.
Oh, wow. Yeah, nothing like that. And even where I grew up in Kansas, there's nothing like that. So nothing to compare it to. I've been to, you know, like, of course, Wheeling, Colorado, and like Ouray. And they have, you know, their big hot spring pool. And I've absolutely loved that. Wish there was something like that around here. But, yeah, no, that's cool. You guys can just roll out up behind the house and right there, easy to get to. That's pretty damn cool.
Yeah, we love it here, man. It's, you know, there's just, I don't know, Nevada is more vacant than it is populated. I mean, as soon as you go east of where I'm at, there's a couple towns here and there, but you can just go dirt all the way to Utah. And then Utah runs a lot of that same program too. It's pretty cool.
And then Colorado as well.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah. The vacant West. I'll take it.
So you guys take Sarah's Jeep out. She drives a pretty built Jeep, right? Like it's like on tons and everything.
Yeah. It's a JK with those Spicer UD60s. It's got 40-inch Toyos on it. It's got RavFlow 3-tube bypasses, you know, PSC hydro assist system, Raceline wheels and anti-rocks. And honestly, the thing is 98% bolt on and it freaking jams. And it's got like 22,000 miles on it. I'd say more than half of that's in the dirt.
Oh, that's a good thing. Leaf looking.
Yeah. That's what we do. I mean, we got that and the Gladiator, and we still spend more time in the JK. I haven't got the Gladiator quite as tuned in yet in time. I think I'm going to get one of those Hemi ones though, when they're an option.
I can't get behind the Gladiator. I'm sorry. I look at them. I see them in traffic. You know, I even see the ones on 37s. God, they're just terrible to me. They look so ugly.
It's definitely a love hate for a lot of people. I love it personally, and I prefer it on 40s, but this one I wanted to build and do some suspension development with ADS for it. So keeping it stock-ish and bolt-on-ish was the goal with this one. But the next one, I think the next one's going to be, you know, 1 tons, 40s, 8 shocks, trailing arms, the whole show. Make it just really dumb.
Yeah, I could see, like, you know, trailing arms and independent four-wheel drive front suspension and just get it to where it floats.
Right. You know, then it's a Toyota pickup at that point. But,
right.
You know, I don't know. There's so many angles and different ways you can go. But I've almost had this one for probably, I don't know, 8 months now. And I've put 13,000 miles on it. And I'll go out on a limb. I will tell you, it is the perfect vehicle. It's perfect.
And so perfect. It does everything. You can just load your two dogs in there and go, right?
I can load the dogs in there. I can load all the camping gear in the bed. I can put the tent on the rack in the bed in 2 minutes. I can haul tube with it. I can haul plate, material, bottles, shocks, drive it wherever the hell I want. It still gets damn near 18 miles per gallon. I see something that looks like a trail. I can hang a right and go send it up that trail. And it is possibly the perfect vehicle.
Which is, you know, for 180 compared to my vision of it. But man, no, I think the guys that are enjoying it, they're a special breed. I think you're a special breed. Jeep's going to listen to this.
Come for a ride someday.
Yeah. Jeep's going to listen to this. Like, yeah. We're never going to give that guy money.
Yeah. Maybe they'll give me money though. I love the Gladiator.
Give me the Hemi one. So man, you got you and Sarah, no kids, but you guys have two pretty awesome dogs. I like their names.
Yep. We got Waylon and Jesse. Waylon was just in here a minute ago. I don't know if you saw his head pop up in the camera, but
I did not know
he was coming to visit. Waylon's 7 now and Jesse's 6. And it's kind of sad because they're, you know, they're putting the years on, but time flies when you're having fun, right?
I mean, 7 and 6, that means they're just midlife at this point. They're probably finally trained, right?
Yeah. Waylon's pretty good. Jesse, she's jury's out on her. She's very stubborn, very sweet, sweet dog, but she is set in her ways.
And so was that planned on names that you had a Waylon and then you decided, oh, we're going to name this one Jesse? Like, was it truly like Waylon Jennings and Jesse Coulter or just,
you got it. Yep. Nice. No, that was the plan. They're from two different breeders. So while their bloodline is probably a little bit inbred, they technically can be husband and wife. It's fine. We had a whole theme. We had a whole theme going. Back in the day, we were in contract with, we were supposed to get a Newfoundland way back in the day, like years before we got Waylon. We were in contract for like 2 years for this Newfoundland, and they kept having parvo and all of them were dying and terrible, terrible things kept happening. And we were going to call that big brown fluffy beast Merle. And, obviously we're going to have a whole bunch of country stars as our animals, and that never panned out. And then just recently we got that little I don't know if you remember seeing that mini Aussie that we had got. We tried to name him Merle, and that I don't think we can have a Merle dog. That just didn't, that dog didn't jive with us at all. Went back to the breeder. Saddest thing ever.
Oh, terrible.
Yeah. I didn't even know that was a thing. I was like, I thought you could just train any dog to be like a normal dog. And this one just wasn't having it. So Merle, we won't have any more dogs named Merle.
So man, so you started, Liberty Mountain Fab in 2013. Did you start it, on the other side of the mountains, or did you, start it when you guys made it to Gardnerville?
So yeah, Liberty Mountain Fab was a function of moving here and having to start a new business license, all that stuff. I mean, obviously you'd know the name Silly Fab from back in the day. Silly Fab didn't get, it was great amongst friends, whatnot, but it didn't get the, professional, how I say that.
It wasn't polished.
It wasn't polished. And when I had jobs for, cause I did a lot of industrial fab too back then. I'd get the like OSHPOD. It's like, I don't know what that stands for. It's like occupational safety hazard, blah, blah, park. So I don't even know what all that stands for, but I did a bunch of jobs for them. And at one point they're like, well, we're not paying a company named Silly Fab. I'm like, what do you mean you're not paying me? It's a business license, totally legal. I'm all certified. Everything's legit. What do you mean you're not paying me? They had me on a big old conference call. So I was like, okay, well, you guys owe me lots and lots of money. I'm like, what in the fucking fuck is an OSHPOD? And I was just like, started talking shit about that. And then I ended up changing it to SFS Industries to get paid. Okay. Silly Fab Service Industries. Yeah, that makes sense. I know they were totally fine with paying me for that. So I kept it kind of funny. And then I moved up here. I was like, oh, I better just pick something, rebrand, make it more legit and rock it out. So here we are.
Turn over a new leaf. But then today you know, it is fab. You can fab. You do fab. You've built chassis. You've built full cars. But you don't do a ton of fab these days, right?
I don't. You know, David Avila is working for me these days, and he handles almost all things fab in the shop. Some days I don't even make it in the shop, man. Sometimes I'm just in the house on the phone selling or doing whatever all day. You know, I think I still know how to fab, but I don't think I'm any good at it anymore. We'll see if I build this Ranger.
I don't think you ever, you know, I think that's like falling, you know, like a riding a bicycle. Like you never fall off the wagon on that. Like you, I think it's like riding a bicycle. I think you can get back on. Maybe you'll be a little bit rusty, but I don't think it goes away. If you had it, I think you keep it.
I hope so. I was never super good at it. I mean, I could build things, I could get by, everything worked, but I'm not like, you know, these Instagram superstars out there that make the finest stuff ever with weld porn and whatnot. I don't have that skill set. I can make things and they come out okay.
Hey, there's still a good spot for that. It still goes the same speed across the whoops.
That's the goal.
Right. So, hey man, so along those lines, as we start talking about whoops and going fast and making cars go fast, what got you? What was the turning point? What was the point that was it just strictly going out with those guys and recognizing that there was this black hole of tuners for off-road suspension for Ultra 4 type vehicles? Was that the thing that happened that you said, you know what, I'm going to do this? Or did you kind of ease your way into doing the tuning work, picking up the shock work, and then we'll talk about your travels across the country doing tuning jobs, your tuning tour?
I dove in as hard and fast as I could when I saw that there was a possibility that I could do it. I think it was KOH 2014, because we hadn't moved yet. I had worked on Doug's car, Doug's axles, the OG. The original car.
And we're going to tell the Doug's axle story.
Great.
You're going to tell Doug's axle story. We just haven't got there yet.
Oh, good. I can set the record straight for all these internet assholes. I think they know everything about it. Cool.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
It was Doug's original car. I built it. I thought it was going to be the shit. We put Fox on it, paid out the nose for it. We were promised the world to get it tuned. You know, they had their people. No names I recognize today worked for Fox at the time. Dude didn't do anything. Like he just kept telling us to go change our preload and go change our springs. And I said, I never opened a shock, never made any changes. And then he like broke his side by side and he wanted to work on that and not work on our shit. And it was one of the more disheartening experiences of my life. you know, after we had worked with Wayne for a little while, and Wayne definitely got the front end of the car working quite a bit better, but then there wasn't any time for the back end. So we just kind of, you know, it was a really tough deal. And I thought to myself, I was like, man, there has got to be a better way. So after the Fox debacle, I was like, well, I don't know what to do. And I started hearing really good things about Radflow. They're like, you can talk to the owner of Radflow, which is Glenn. He's a fantastic human and definitely was one of the reasons why I ended up in this situation. I was able to ask him a million questions. He'd solve whatever problem I had at the time and just help push me in the right direction. So we put Radflow on the car. It wasn't especially fast out of the box. A couple people tried to tune on it a little bit. There wasn't a lot of time. Didn't get a lot better. Then I put a lot of time into it, not knowing what the hell I was doing, and got it going quite a bit faster. I mean, I think I had it in this one section we were testing. I think it was like 70 miles per hour. And I was like, I was really happy with that speed at the time, considering the car had always gone like 40 or 50 out there. And then we had another professional tuner come in, and he ended up dialing the car all the way back to 55 right there. So when he left, I turned it back up to where I had it, and we were back up into the 70s. I was like, okay, I think I understand this a little bit. So I started doing it for free for everyone I could get my hands on, all my friends, whatever. I'd tune their stuff up just for the cost of materials. Everything went faster and felt better. And that's what started it. And here we are, man. I mean, it just took off like wildfire when people found out there was someone in their area that could take care of stuff. The East Coast thing, I'll put that on James Cantrell. He started the East Coast program. He wanted me to come up there and tune everybody's stuff, and that I flew in for one trip, and that was amazing.
You've done multiple trips now. I mean, I'm going to call them the tuning tours, right? You take your big trailer, you load up all your crap, everything you, and you can't haul everything, but you haul a lot. And then you head east. And I think you just got back from one of those trips a few weeks ago, right?
I did, just last week, actually. I was in, was it last week? Maybe it was 2 weeks ago. It all runs together anymore, man. But I just got back from Kansas and Missouri, just doing a quickie, you know, got some decent results. I don't know. I'm pretty much handing the East Coast to Chris Wyant. Did his big block race shop. Super cool dude. He's taken quite an interest in this, and the market's just too dang big for me to service everybody. So we just kind of work hand in hand. I answer some of his questions. He buys stuff from me. That's more or less our agreement. I mean, he doesn't have to. He could run away anytime he wants, but he's a super solid dude, and, you know, is making it worth my while, and I'm making it worth his while. So it's working out good.
No, that is good to hear. Now, so is it harder, or difficult to find locations, you know, east of Colorado to tune? Like, if you're in Kansas, I'm from Kansas. How are you finding hits, so to speak, to tune off of?
The Kansas spot was at Tom Jellison's house. And that was, I mean, it's just on his property. He's just got some climbs there and with a couple of ledges and whatnot. I mean, it's just basically like rock bouncer stuff you'd do, except it's right there on his property. So we were able to tune a couple of vehicles there and get them kind of ready to go do their thing. And it wasn't a big deal. So I don't know where else you'd go, but that definitely worked at his place.
Well, so, okay, now you're opening my eyes up. So you're tuning for rock bouncing guys as well.
You know, when I go back east, I would say not exclusively, but this trip, I didn't touch an Ultra 4 car. I guess, and I touched one X-Ultra 4 car, which was the old Blue Torch car that Anthony Yaunt owns now.
Okay.
He did. I mean, he did a lot converting that to make a rear engine solid axle car go up hills. It does freaking awesome.
Well, I mean, that's kind of the thing that we've talked about. You know, I certainly talked about it with Cantrell just recently, was exactly that. The evolution of the Ultra 4 guys, their evolution, the impacts it's had on the rock bouncer guys, where you've had guys like Rick Mooneyham or Eric Miller, James Cantrell show up, Derek West. I almost forgot Derek, because, I mean, Derek has won so many events down there. They've taken Ultra 4 cars, 4,400 cars, and they've shown up at rock bouncing events. And, you know, when they slam into the transition to go vertical, they soaked it up and they're able to, you know, get horsepower to the ground versus for so many years, it was the rock bouncer guys were just like, they get a set of coilovers or coil carriers, slap it on, and that was it.
Oh, yeah. no tuning, off the shelf shocks. I don't know if they even would have been called that if they had been shock tuning from the get go. It'd be a different sport.
And those guys opened eyes, you know, that, well, I mean, I got to reach back to the 4400s and Ultra Fours, you know, them leveraging as much as they could off of the past 50 years of desert racing, but then that was nice, but then making a solid axle do that. And all the time that I know have been around Wayne Israelson and, you know, all the time Wayne spent doing things that guys like Arribe and company couldn't. Now those, don't get me wrong, like Arribe, Mike Kim, all those guys, they've all caught on. They've all, you know, when your brain works a certain way, it's kind of hard to turn it off. You know, they want to make a car faster no matter what type of car it is. So they've all gotten on the, you know, the solid axle, on board with solid axles, and gotten on board with the four-wheel drive IFS cars as well, which now we're seeing those go faster and faster in trophy truck or T1s or whatever that are now four-wheel drive.
Right.
They're making those handle differently as well. Those handle differently and they tune differently than a two-wheel drive. So it's cool to see the rock bouncing crowd, the Southeast United States, be able to leverage what's been going on out in Ultra 4.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and that sport is evolving now, which is making it way harder on me or anybody that's tuning them for that matter, is that they're adding short course to the bottoms of all these climbs to make it way more entertaining for the spectators or just add another element of time to the runs. So now we're taking these rigs that are purpose-built to go straight up a mountain, and now we're trying to jump over double jumps. And we're talking like Dana 80 steer axles and no weight behind the rear axle and like just a few gallons of fuel and an engine that's over the front axle and a foot up in the air. It's just absolutely doesn't want to jump properly. It just wants to front flip off everything. And oh man, it's Chris Wynn's problem now.
Yeah. There you go.
You get all the best. Yeah. As I think more people are going to start looking like Ultra 4 cars over there with the more they change everything, it's going to be a reality. It just has to happen.
Well, so, as their course evolves, right? I mean, if the course is strictly an uphill drag race with some ledges in it, then yeah, then that's what we have today. That's what we look at the jungle gyms. I call it, you know, jungle gym, the rock bouncers today. It's all, you know, there's some aesthetics to it, but it's mostly protection.
Yeah.
Like you're trying to protect equipment and parts and driver, and at the same time make it to where it doesn't want to exactly pogo backwards off the hill on everything.
Right. It, you know, totally makes sense. Yeah. It's just going to be tough. Like if they put the double jump on the mountain, you know, okay, it's a smooth part of an uphill. Cool. Put the jump up there. Don't put it in the flats. We don't want to jump these things downhill. Not cool.
Yeah. They just go ass over tea kettle.
Right. Yeah. And it's like, out west, you got all your rock crawlers that have no up travel. Everybody like uses the term unload. And then you go to the East Coast, and now no one's got any down travel anymore. And it's all up travel. And great, it's great for taking hits, but jumping is not cool because you just strap out immediately. And then the thing, you know, just adds to that front flip effect. It's things are going to change. People are going to have to change their programs up big time to evolve with the sport for sure.
Well, I think, but that's also all motorsports, right? Once everybody once you tap out, you need to change the game. And you just, you take the same course and you just move the cones or you run the course backwards or, you know, whatever it takes to continue to challenge the people that are coming out and paying money to run their cars on it.
There you go. I mean, look at the last 10 years of Ultra 4. Wow. What a change. Yeah. So wild.
Yeah. And we can talk about, you know, just at King of the Hammers, you know, toughest single day race in the world.
Yeah.
But I don't know. Is it, is it, if you never get out of there, you know, the rock trails are beat in pretty good. There's bypasses on any of the hard stuff. So you can get, you know, 50 feet up the side of the canyon. There's a nice super highway built in up there. I mean, that's
still, well, it's a game of strategy too.
Yeah.
You know, if your pre-running game and your course marking is on point, I mean, you've got an advantage over the competition for sure. And there's a lot of luck. You get caught in a traffic jam. I mean, obviously, the way they've routed the course lately has made it way better for not getting these log jams that were just completely ruining people's days.
Oh, it completely takes, you know, half or three quarters of the field completely out of contention. So I'd absolutely have to give, you know, JT and Dave and company major kudos on that. But at the same time, it's like, man, is it still really the single hardest day race? I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know. I still love the hell out of it. That's my home. You know, those guys are, they created their own industry, and it is incredible.
Absolutely. So actually, King of the Hammers is actually the first place I met you. You were coming back from, and you probably won't remember this because it was in such passing. It was pitch black. The way the spotlights were going, you were walking into spotlights, and I was going away from them so I could see your face as I'm approaching you. I'm like, Phil? And you're like, yeah, man. And I was like, hey, Wyatt Pemberton. We shook hands, and then nice to meet you. Nice to meet you. And I kept heading to the fire pit, and you were headed north into, you know, the rowdier part of Hammertown, not south of the fire pit where it's like retirement homes and Miller Racing and the Gilberts, you know. It's like,
yeah.
The quiet, you know, that, you know, they're a bit in bed by 8 o'clock and there's a Luby's on the corner, you know.
Yeah. I mean, it depends what it was in my hand.
No, yeah. I think you were just hoofing it. I think it was pretty late too, but that was the only time I'd actually really ever met you in person. But I made it a point to, grab your hand and say something. And then I think from there, maybe 10 or 15 minutes later, I had the amazing opportunity to meet a fellow rock zombie, actually a bunch of fellow rock zombies of yours, Danny Edwards.
Oh boy.
And
oh yeah. Old Danny.
And it was sideways from there. Danny and I actually almost fought the first time we met. Now, I love him. Yeah. We almost got a fight. Yeah. Actually I was wearing a SDHQ floral print hat. And
oh no.
And he's like, oh, you're from Texas. And he kept trying to put my hat on, take my hat off my head and put it on his head. And I was like, who the F is this asshole? And it kind of went sideways. And then all of a sudden it didn't go sideways. We ended up being buddies. And now, you know, I message with him every handful of days, something will come from him or I'll send him something. And they're never something that you'd ever show a significant other that you care about or your wife, let her read them. You would never, these aren't messages that you... I would forward it to you, Phil.
standard Danny activities. Standard, yeah, he's Danny a great activity. Guy.
And
fantastic.
And you've got another buddy in there that I know he gets a, you know, well, I want to congratulate him on the Talent Tank for this, but Tom Liu.
Oh yeah.
Tom Liu. Now, did he just finish fire training?
He hasn't not finished that. He's going to be doing fire and paramedic stuff probably through the rest of the year. And then I think a little bit of school in the spring, but yeah,
but he's far along though. Like he once he went in like a probie or whatever his little deal, you know, the initial start of his fire training, he got off social media. He walked away from everything. I was like, man, I had to send him a message, text him and do like, dude, I'm proud of you. That's awesome. Well done.
Right. Yeah, man. I'm so stoked for the guy. I mean, he and Morgan are just building an awesome life. They moved about 30 minutes from us, a little further out than we live. When Tom is, you know, finishes all his stuff and he's a legit fireman working 48 hours on and the rest of the time he's just off. You know, obviously he can take shifts or he can do whatever he wants, but, you know, he'll have a little bit of commute to get the money where he wants to work. But then, he'll be off 4 or 5 days a week, just living the dream out here. And Morgan picked up a job with Lyon County Sheriff's Office. She's a dispatcher there. Yeah, it's just cool watching their lives build.
Evolve.
They're young. And
so tell me, I didn't quite finish what I want to talk to you about shock stuff, but I'm going to stay on the Rock Zombies here for a little bit. What year did you join the Rock Zombies?
Day one, man. I was right there at the beginning. Big Rob and Jeremy Dick were the founding members and I was the first member. So, you know, I guess I was probably 18 or 19 at the time. We were doing stuff, rock zombie type stuff, 99 or 2000, real early on, but everyone was hammered drunk. So we can't really pin it down. So I think we pretty much just say two. I think we pretty much just say 2000 now was when it was became a thing.
How many members are you guys today?
No one knows, man. No one knows. I'd say we're active probably 20 to 24 members, but there's a lot of OGs and stuff that, you know, pop up now and then, and or we just don't hear from them at all, but we know they're still alive and might want to come wheeling again someday. So there's probably 30-ish people that are associated with the club as members, I guess.
Oh, much smaller than I thought.
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, then you got the imposters running around like Colorado, like Rock Zombie Outlaws or something. I think it's an RC club, but we haven't got to fight them yet. So, oh well.
They haven't worn the same, you know, the same bottom rocker on their hoodie.
They haven't pulled it off yet, but when that time comes, we'll do work.
We'll sick Danny Edwards on them.
Oh yeah. Yeah. That'll be their worst nightmare.
Damn straight. So, with that though, the one thing that, you know, I think everyone who's familiar, have even heard the Rock Zombies name, not just that you guys are an off-road club, but that you guys put on this amazing, amazing, amazing car wash every year. How do you convince your wives to put this thing on and girlfriends? But how?
Well, I don't know. I think, everybody wants to go out there and shake it. So, you know, it's just a party. And most of the cars getting washed are people we know anyways, at least in the industry. Not too many randoms. No stalkers yet, at least not too bad. It's not super tough. It gives us all a reason to eat good for a couple of months and try to get our acts together and then, you know, go out there and ham it up for everybody. But the girls, we didn't do one for a couple of years, I don't think. And then this last year, I mean, all the girls put in just tons and tons of effort to just get in killer shape for that. And it was just awesome. Everybody was stoked. Everybody was happy with themselves and raised a bunch of money and were able to donate it. And it just, it was a great event and I hope we do more.
No, I think it was. I mean, it looked awesome. It was the only part I found that was a little awkward was once you came out in the G string and I was like, I think that was like, you took it a little too far, but I mean,
feel like that wasn't this year or last year. I'm not saying it didn't happen. I just don't know when.
I'm not saying I didn't just make it up either. So
I know I've done it before. I just don't know when.
No, I think that's a really cool, fundraiser you guys do. Who do you guys end up donating the funds to?
I think this time, I mean, Big Rob would definitely be a better person or probably anyone else in the club that is more familiar with it, but I think this went to El Dorado County for the new pumper truck for pumping the toilets all over the Rubicon. Nice. So that's, yeah. And with as much use as the Rubicon sees, it's a disaster. We just gotta, we need that kind of stuff out there because people obviously can't clean up after themselves properly. So it's just going to have to happen.
Yeah. I mean, I love humans and I hate people.
You got it.
That's it. I think humans are amazing. We do amazing stuff, but people suck, especially in groups.
Yeah.
We're filthy. We just are. We're terrible. Even when we try, like, you know, like I mean, yeah, you got it. Oh man. Well, hey, let's jump back to, there's one big piece of, shock work that I left off. I've got it starred here on my sheet here that I want to talk about, but it's the long shocks, the 4800 class. Yeah. You're kind of, this was probably where the Shock Jesus name came in, but this was your own design. No, you're wrong. People can go Google up what a coil pass is and it's kind of similar, but you took this technology that you created by marrying and mating a whole bunch of parts together to create something that was class legal, packaged good, and got the damn job done. And now you've sold, 40 sets now?
I think we're getting there. There's a few in the shop right now on deck. And I, you know, man, I thought I had created something that had never been seen before. I was like, I'm going to absolutely break the internet in half with this. It's going to be the best thing ever.
You kind of did though. You did break the internet.
It was different.
Yeah.
It broke the internet, but not the way I wanted it to, but it has been amazing. watching all the haters that said none of it was going to work, all this stuff wasn't going to happen, yada, yada, yada. It's just not, it wouldn't fly, right? And then we got out there and we tested and tested and tested, and man, not one of them has got hurt yet. All the ones that have been running, some have been raced for years now and trail wheeled and whatever, and not one of them is damaged.
So tell us exactly what it is. Tell us exactly what the theory you had, the rules and constraints you had to operate in, and then what you built and then how it works.
Okay. So hopefully most of the listeners know what a bypass shock is, whether you're talking internal bypass or external bypass. Well, internal bypass is a limited shock in a way. Yes, you can tune until it's perfect, but it's almost all internal tuning. You can have your compression clickers on the outside on your reservoir or whatever, and maybe some other little doodads here and there. But for the most part, it's internal tuning. On the back of a vehicle, something that might go from short course to desert, you're probably going to want to make some changes to that rear shock. The front is limited. It can get by. It can do whatever it needs to do pretty much in the same form it was in for short course or desert. But the rear needs some changes. An external bypass shock allows for that. That's your no compromise shock. That's what's going to be on any 8-shock car, pretty much any desert truck, any trophy truck, whatever is going to have a bypass shock on it. Obviously, you know, they vary from in quality. What I've built here is it's just a bypass shock that holds coils. There's nothing particularly crazy about it. Everybody thinks it does all kinds of witchcrafty things that it doesn't do. It was just a way around the rules to make a shock that really does a good job for the application. And it's really, really, really simple. And now that I don't sell a ton of them, I don't really care if people figure out how they work at this point, but it's not doing anything crazy. Like if I wanted it to be a regular bypass shock again, take my thing off, put a regular eyelet back on, it's a regular shock again. It doesn't, not crazy, but it's worked out in my favor for sure. You can make car go real good on them.
Well, yeah, I wasn't trying to get you to give up any of the secret sauce or anything like that, but I do know you initially when you kind of came out with this, you obviously knew you were doing something right, because when you know you're doing something right, it means you have haters and people try to knock you off.
You got it. Yep. There's a lot of haters. Only one knockoff guy, a lot of haters.
But you know, most of the time the knockoff guy never seems to execute at the level needed.
Yeah. I mean, he was doomed from the start just with the parts he was using. And pretty much everybody on the internet saw what that is. So I don't think I even need to mention the manufacturer's parts, but yeah, you can guess.
Well, I mean, when you have a team of engineers.
Yeah. Team of shock tuners and engineers working around the clock to make you the finest thing ever.
Yeah. We saw through that pretty quickly, which parlays us right into a discussion on things in the internet world and the social media spectrum that are viral, that go one way, go another way. Let's call it a social proof. Let's call it a little bit social justice, but let's talk about your good friend, Doug Evans. He's the one who got you into Ultra 4 racing back in roughly 2011. Doug, we talked about him a little bit ago in the show, and he's Dirty Money Racing. And Doug was building a new car, put down a whole big wad of money on some axles. And, you know, people have heard of Doug's axles. I mean, they're almost as famous as Randy's donuts.
Yeah. Go ahead.
Oh, no. That's the opener right there. I don't even know if I'll leave it up to you if you want to name the name of the company and the story around.
Yeah,
because I don't know the full story. I don't think I know the full story. I think I know that Doug got ripped off.
Oh, yeah. I'll dish it. Here we go. All right. So Doug being Doug, he's going to want the baddest of the baddest for parts. As new things come out, he'll research them some, check out whatever's new, cool, whatever. I think where this all started was Doug calls up Mask Motorsports, and he's like, I'm building a thing. I need some stuff. So he gets an 850-horse trophy truck engine for the 4800 class. Super cool idea. He's going to have all the motor in the world. Then he gets a hold of Maximum Transmission and has a Turbo 400, SH400 reed case built to the nines, like nothing else you could do to it. Baddest thing ever. A Hero 3-speed, And then he's like, well, what kind of axles can I top this thing off with to have just the most killer package ever? Torque 14 bolts is what he came up with. So Torque agreed to build Doug, like to basically use Doug's funds more or less to finance building a high pinion 14 bolt. So he's going to have high pinion 14s front and rear. This is going to be like the newest, hottest thing. $16,500 gets wired over to Jim Jackson of Torque. It's the lowercase Torque, not the Torque Masters, not the good people. It's the lowercase ones, the bad ones out of Utah. So Jim takes the money. Jim doesn't do anything. 2 years goes by, and I'm sitting here. I got Doug's chassis done. I've got his motor here for a year. I've got his tranny, transfer case, various other parts, tires and wheels, everything. Everything's here. Need some axles. And 2 years goes by. I'm like, Doug, can we let the dogs out on this one yet? And he's like, oh, just give it another minute. And then I think Jim blew smoke up his ass one last time. Doug's like, all right, do it. And I had no idea it was going to go like that. I just made that one post kind of showing what was going on. And, you know, we had two or three people who were like, that's not how it went down. I've had perfect this, that, and the other with them. Doug's lying. Doug doesn't know, blah, blah, blah. So, yeah, we just had a few of those. And everyone else was like, let's kill the bastards. We're going to have, you know,
pitchforks
and torches. Yeah. You're right. We were ready to go. And it definitely lit a fire under Jim's ass. You know, he didn't do a goddamn thing for Doug, but he did get a whole lot of other people's orders out the door, probably trying to save a little face because he knew he wasn't going to be able to do anything for Doug. And Doug was like, okay, well, I'll take my money back. And the guy's like, nope, can't do that. And then he's like, I can give you a low pinion 14 bolt rear. So he was going to have a whole rear built out. And dude kept streaming along weeks, months, whatever, never happened. He's like, I'll do it if you get Phil to stop. And, Doug's like, well, Phil's his own person. He's not going to stop until I get an axle or money. I was like, yeah, no, I don't plan on stopping ever. Like, go ahead, try to sue me, try to do whatever you can. I don't know what their current status is, like what their reality is, but just a couple weeks ago, their company showed closed, which was pretty cool. But that con artist has his fingers in a whole lot of different stuff. And if you'll remember, and I didn't know this, but Torque was Portal Tech back in the day. Portal Tech also screwed everybody. So, you know, Jim Jackson, man, you know, his day of karma is coming. I don't know how it's going to get served to him. Like, it's going to be like the O'Doyle's rule moment and
they shoot off a cliff.
Yeah, he's going to slip on a banana peel and land on a knife in through his forehead, but not die yet. And then walk into a bus or something. I don't freaking know, but it's going to suck when that day comes. Cause that is a bad, bad dude.
And you got to believe that happened. I mean, we all subscribe to that theory, right? What goes around comes around back, you know, karma, man. I know a lot of terrible fuckers and that's my only word for them. They have screwed people out of so many things and just been in general bad people. And then we go and we lose, you know, good people, you know, they pass away. We lose, you know, pillars and, you know, these really great humans.
Yeah.
And they get they're the ones that get taken out. Not the guy that, you know, has ripped everybody off and is just in bad, just a, you know, would shove his mother in front of a bus to pick up a penny, you know?
Right. Well, you know, there's probably whoever's looking down from above doesn't want to deal with that person. They're like, yeah, you know, we're going to delay this as long as we can. That person's going to suck up here or wherever they end up. So
what amazing insight that is. I never thought about it that way, but maybe that is what it is.
Maybe hell's not even an option. Maybe it's just everyone's got to go up there and it's like, oh, just leave them home. That dude sucks.
Yeah. St. Pete, you know, sitting at the pearly gates, he's like, he's a procrastinator. Who knew?
Right.
Why do today what I can do tomorrow?
I hear that. I'm right with him.
Oh, that's man. Funny. Oh, so, well, there's the story on Doug's axles, man. So, you know, with what you're doing with tuning and in the early days of doing tuning work, you were doing, you know, certainly anyone's car that you get your hand on. Now, today you do it as a business and you're making money out, but I'm friends with, like Joshua West, and he does, you know, he does engine tuning and talk about, you know, how many people hit him up for basically free tunes, not, or free tech. and how that wears his day out, and he's had to figure out ways to balance what may be a sale and not a sale and supporting his customers and supporting maybe a future customer. How is that in the shock tuning world? It has to be everybody. It seems the more magic involved and the less transparency, the more people want for free. Is that fair?
Yeah, I think you're right, man. It's a constant onslaught of people asking, basically people who think I haven't heard that line before or something. They're going to ask me in such a way that I'm just going to accidentally give them information that would normally make me money. And, you know, I've got my ways around it. I will do consult stuff, and it's not terribly expensive. Like, you could basically have me on call for an amount of money. I'll answer all your questions to a certain point, and it's not super expensive. And then we get people doing that kind of stuff. And then there'll be people that just, can you tell me what spring rates these things are? And then I'll like, or what spring rates I need for this thing, you know, like super quick. And man, I do, you know, I'll do 20, 30 deals a week. Wow. Sometimes a day I'll have to like go through all my invoices and look up that name and be like, if I don't have anything from that name, I'll be like, so what did you buy for me? Did you buy these springs? And they're wrong. They're like, oh yeah. Well, I'm like, I don't have an invoice. Can you show me your invoice? Like where I'm responsible for fixing your spring rate situation. And they're like, oh, well, it wasn't like that. I was just hoping you'd, you know, and it just goes on and on. It's always a thing.
Always a thing. Man.
Yeah. I wouldn't say half my day, but it definitely happens.
Eats at the productivity.
For sure.
And here's the thing, what I've learned, certainly, you know, I'm certainly one that would be like, if you can get something for free, absolutely would take it. Right. But on the flip side, as I've gotten older in age, I've figured out that, you know, people have to put food on the table, and they have to make their car notes, and they got to pay their cell phone bills. And if you're not paying them, you're kind of stealing from them. And is stealing from somebody the right thing? And for me, it's a no. It's like a hard no, but I didn't learn it immediately. Took some time. Not that I'm not a bad person. I'm not saying like stealing is right. What I'm saying is I didn't recognize that what I was doing was not necessarily on the up and up with the guy that I was doing work or trying to do work with or get information from. I didn't fully recognize that. I just, you know, thought that, you know, my time was my time and their time was their time, and why not help? Now I know it's, the money isn't the commodity. It's the time is the commodity, and the money buys that time. Is that,
you got it?
Yeah. And that's sad. And like I said, I think that with age that comes, with responsibility that comes. It's like when you, you go to a restaurant and you get a meal, and you know, the server serves and everything, and the meal was freaking terrible. Do you not tip? Well, no, you actually still tip. You complain, but you still tip because the server that served you had no say in the way that food was made. Hell, half the time, maybe even the cook that or the people that are cooking or doing the food prep, they might not even have a say in it. It might have been whoever was doing the procurement and bought shitty food that week or bought, you know, they switched from one company to another company on suppliers. So I get it. I mean, those are life lessons, I guess, but you know, when you don't tip, then you know, you're kind of screwing people. And if you go through life like with this mindset that of screwing people knowingly or unknowingly, you know, I think it adds friction.
I totally know what you're saying. I mean, and I get it. Like with some people just don't understand that. And sometimes you just have to tell them, and that brings them around pretty quick. But some people just straight up don't get it. And they'll have to like lay it out in layman's terms of like, oh, you do heavy equipment service. Okay, come change this seal on my Bobcat Ram for free. And like, why the hell would I do that? Be like, there you go. The same, why would I tell you my intellectual property has value because you want it, you need it because you don't have it. You know, I have to get compensated for that most of the time. You know, and honestly, how someone comes at me is totally determines how my disposition back to them. Someone might ask me in such a way like, hey man, I know that this shouldn't be free and feel free to charge me whatever you want for it, yada, yada, yada. I just need to know this, and I'm not in a position to, you know, I don't know how to do that. And if they come at me like that, I might just, you know, yeah, it might only take me 2 seconds to answer. I'm not going to charge them $100 to do something like that when they come at me humble and kind, you know, that's just being a good human.
Well, I just saw this. It was a Facebook post fairly recently. No, it might have even been on LinkedIn. It was the guy sent the company an invoice for $1,000. They sent it back to him and said, "Hey, I need you to break down the invoice." And so he sends it back to him, and it's $990 for a consult, $10 for a hammer. And they said, you know, then they responded back, "Well, we'll pay you for the hammer." And he's like, "Well," or they asked clarification about the $990 and then why the hammer. And he said, "Well, the hammer is the tool I needed. The $999 is the experience to know where to hit with the hammer."
Exactly.
I fixed it because they of course went to the shop foreman. What'd he do? Well, he took a hammer and he hit the thing and it started working. Oh, that's all he did? Well, we're not going to pay him the $1,000. Well, okay. But did you know where to hit on the machine with the, no. And that's why that's what you're paying a guy like Phil Accardi for, and why you're paying for that shock tune is because of the experience and time and effort that you've put in, that you're paying for a service. You're paying for, exactly like you said, intellectual capital.
You got it.
Yeah, man. I'll say this in this way. The things that you guys are able to do with cars, it's not magic. It's not smoke and mirrors. It's a lot of very heavy math, along with a little bit of art, and that art is visualizing, seeing what the car is doing. And sometimes if you're riding in it, it's a feel thing, but it's taken years and years and miles
right
to get to where you have that feel. I mean, that's a surgeon's feel. So I see absolute full value in tuning. And it's what's been cool is, you know, Ultra 4 coming around to it in, you know, the late 2000s. As you know, King of the Hammers type events start coming on, endurance start coming on. We weren't really tuning cars back in the XRRA days. Make sure that's enunciated correctly. But you know, they were doing that in Score. They were doing that in Best in the Desert at the time. Now what we've seen is now we're seeing it. You know, the rock bouncers have seen the value in tuning and the value in making their cars handle better. And it's very cool to see a guy like you who has also saw the value in it, but also saw that there was this, you know, a void, a very large, you know, a vacuum of knowledge and intellect and skill set to handle all of these race cars and all these off-road vehicles that are out on the, you know, the trails today that could benefit from your tuning, that you saw that opportunity, you took it by the horns, and you've built a business around it. And now you're going on 6 years. I mean, that's not an insignificant number. And obviously, I mean, you're pretty skinny, so I don't know how well you're eating, but I know you're putting some food on the table, right?
Honestly, man, the last couple of years I'm killing it. And I love that, but I don't have any time. I don't have any time. Like my life is not my own right now. That's why I look like a freaking disaster right now. It's like up until, you know, I'm eating and invoicing. And then like this morning, I mean, I'm my own shipping department and just trying to run the entire show over here, short of the fab stuff. It's just killing me. So I'm just waiting for this election to come and go. I want to see how this turns out. And if it goes our way, even if it doesn't go our way, if I don't see a collapse in my business, I'm going to be expanding and hiring people, inventory, and trying to take some of the load off so I can, you know, maybe make other people's lives better and then really focus on, I feel like I'm losing, you know, I'm going to be losing customers soon because I just can't service everybody anymore. So.
Well, that is the next step, right? So I do want to talk about the future with you and where that's going. But I want one more question right here in the middle of where we're at talking about Liberty Mountain Fab. Have you had do you get approached with some regularity for guys pitching and asking for sponsorships?
Not lately. No, I think people know I'm just too small to really do anything about right now. And I sponsor shit. There's probably 10 people I sponsor for shock tuning, where they just don't get a bill. And some of them are amazing at shouting me out all the time. And some I'm just like, why am I doing this?
But, well, I did. Yeah. I did see a cool one. Is the Gomez brothers. You rebuilt shocks for the Gomez's, right?
That was a ton of fun. because they have a lot of shocks.
A lot.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then what'd they do? They helicopter delivered or just helicopter picked up?
Yeah. They picked up some bypasses on the chopper that day. And that was super cool. And if we did it again, they could totally land at our house now. We had just got it stained when they did it before. So I didn't want them to kick up a bunch of dust right then. So it would have been super cool if they landed in the yard, but that would be for next time.
Yeah, those are good guys. Yeah, hopefully. There is certainly a Talent Tank interview case over there at Mountain F Enterprises, but we have yet to get an interview scheduled with them. But,
oh, yeah, you got to do that for sure. Get all three of them in a room and just...
I don't know if I can do that.
That would be... You better have some tequila lined up, and it's going to be a party. Boys right there.
Do one at a time. Yeah, they are really good guys. All right, so, man, yeah, let's talk about the future. The future is, you know, well, with COVID, so you went into COVID... You had a pretty big inventory and you elected not to backfill your inventory because you just didn't know what was going on. And no one did. You could have gone one way and it would have gone the other way. Like if you had continued to stock up, the economy could have continued to fail. No one would have been buying anything. You would have been sitting on this huge pile of inventory and been broke right. And out of business. You elected to go the other route. You didn't restock. Now you're kind of paying the price because your inventory, people have not stopped consuming. Right. They bought you out of house and home practically.
Last month was record sales for me, short of, I think December last year was my highest sales month ever. And then last month was like record sales for not being that month, which absolutely blows my mind. The month before was fantastic too. I can't complain. I don't have steady sales right now. I can tell you that. But what's happening is I'll get inundated for like 2 days in a row and then like nothing for the rest of the month. It's just, it's the craziest thing ever. I don't understand how it works, but yeah, not having inventory right now, I can't service the impulse buyers, but through some of my different distributors and some of the manufacturers that I use, there is product and a lot of times I can get my hands on it. So that's handy. Custom orders, forget about it. You're waiting forever.
And then some. So what the future holds is, well, as we get through November and you know, what do we think? You know, what about November the 4th, November the 5th, COVID goes away?
I'm thinking there's going to be this NorCal Rock Race this weekend. People are already making noise about dropping shocks off after for service. Then we're going to have Nationals in Oklahoma and whatever other stuff happens in the middle. I feel like I'm still going to get inundated with shock rebuilds before KOH, provided KOH is a thing. I think it's going to be a thing, right?
I think so.
You can't imagine that, as greedy as that state is, they'd let, you know, however many millions of dollars slip through their fingers that event produces.
But they've done it for everything else though. They've literally let billions of dollars languish, right? They've literally taken everyone's savings and just let people just ate through everyone's savings, their safety net, everything. This country so far is somewhat, you know, chopped off their nose to spite their face on this deal.
You know, that's a really good point, man. I didn't think about all the other stuff, but going forward, I don't know. Even our communist governor is starting to open some stuff up again, getting ready for bigger events. I don't know. We'll see.
It's sad. But so, yeah, so you plan to get back to restocking, build up inventory, get back where you were, adding shocks, adding springs, adding sway bars, adding limit straps. You thinking about getting your own line of limit straps?
I don't think so, because my buddy Chris Elrod, obviously of Elrod Performance Pro Straps, that's one of my best buddies, and he produces the finest straps on the planet. So they're, unless he wanted to do one of my logos on his straps, that'd be the only way I'd do it, because I won't buy another strap. Fantastic stuff.
Oh, there you go. Well, yeah, that's what you need. You need some, some Liberty Mountain specials.
Yeah, and I'm sure he'd do it too. You know, he's a great guy, for sure.
Maybe the metal on the end is, you know, gold or something.
There you go. So, that's funny.
And then your goals over there is, right, you're trying to get to the point where you can buy some time, right? You want to buy yourself some time out of there, buy yourself some clarity of mind. So hire some folks. You look to be adding to your human capital?
Yeah, I think we're going to need, I need somebody that can bill and run the business side of things, like keeping certain things up to date and, you know, all the proper licensing and everything that needs to be in place, you know, payroll, et cetera, all legit, making it easier for me to not have to deal with any of that, or the wife to not have to deal with any of that, taking care of all the swag. Like if I could remember to restock like all the t-shirts and hats and everything, I mean, I'd make a bunch of money doing that too. Cause everybody always wants that stuff. I'm like, oh, I failed to order it again. Sorry.
I didn't even know you had hats and shirts, man. I need to order a shirt from you.
Yeah. I'll get you set up. Maybe I can show something back in that Pelican for you.
Nah, you don't have to do that. That's not how that works. This is the whole conversation we had about asking your friends for stuff for handouts. No, I'm not. That's the opposite of how I work, man. But
right,
yeah,
right.
Man, I've got one more question at the end of the day. This is my last one. And then, you know, if you have any questions, but my last question here is, what are your thoughts on the next steps for Ultra 4? Where do we go from here?
Well, I never really gave that much thought. I don't know, man. Things seem... Go ahead.
I'm going to kind of bait you on this, and not bait, just kind of feed. Because I feel like we've actually... And it's actually out of your backyard, practically. We've actually... feels like in rock sports, we've actually seen some regression. We've seen crawling coming back. We've seen crawling competition. We've seen Jesse Haynes, and we've seen Cody Wagner, and we've seen these guys come back and... So I feel like maybe there's some regression. I'm not saying us all getting back on the trail is going to happen, but I don't know what the future is for Ultra 4. I feel like this COVID thing is a really nice opportunity to kind of step back and go, what are the goals? And I feel like there's some big announcements coming out in the next couple of weeks of big name companies getting behind Ultra 4 guys for the 21 season. So there's some people that are absolutely hitching their programs to rocket ships.
Oh, wow. But, well, that's really cool.
But the rest of everybody, this regression of rock crawling. So I don't know what the next thing is, but I'm asking you, what do you think? Like, do you think it's sponsors and getting money in, and it's media deals, marketing deals, or do you think it's, you see any places we're going to see evolution in the cars themselves?
Man, I mean, I keep getting blindsided by the car evolution. What keeps making the next thing go bigger, better, faster? I don't know what the next big step's going to be for all that. I do know that the vast majority of people that race Ultra 4 don't do it because they think they're going to get rich. They don't do it because they want to be on TV. They just do it because they've got, maybe they don't have the money, but they're going to scrape together enough money to go and duke it out with their friends, and they just enjoy the heck out of it.
That's what I think. I mean, certainly I'm along those lines. That's the folks that are doing it.
Yeah. And then you'll have your top few percentile that have those big money deals, have that marketing presence, and go for the gusto in that direction. Yeah. That's probably going to grow. There's probably going to be more people that are doing it. And the televised coverage, I mean, man, I don't feel like I missed a thing from the race, King of the Hammers race, that is, sitting on my couch last year. I mean, I was home by the time they were racing the trophy trucks. So I got to see the entire 4400 race from my couch, and it was fantastic. So I just see the viewership growing, therefore the sponsorship stuff growing, evolution of the machine. I don't know who's going to come up with the next thing. Is it going to be a Joe Thompson deal, a Campbell, a Horschel? I mean, have you had Horschel on here yet?
Oh man, I want to. Everybody wants me to. Will Gentile, hopefully Horschel listens to this, but Will Gentile has challenged me on that. I mean, like, you know, Horschel is an amazing individual from what I've seen. Now, I've never talked to him though. I've never met him. I've heard that he would be a difficult interview, so I have that certainly hanging in the back of my mind. But that standpoint, he has really pushed the technical boundaries and the engineering of the car. He's really pushed the engineering of the car. And we've seen that in Lauren's car, and we've seen that in Paul. And Paul is, not only is he a driver, he's also a fabricator, and he's also a designer. And when you get a guy that can drive building his own car,
you get special things happen because right. he knows how it should feel and how it should move and how it should react. And then he changes it until I look at it this way. This is a crazy analogy, but it's like a combination lock, an Ultra 4 race car, or actually many things, even life. It's a trillion combination lock. There's a trillion options on this combination lock. And Paul seems to take that and he builds something and then the lock doesn't open exactly the way he wanted it to. So he makes one change. Trillion combinations, he makes one change and then goes and does it again and then makes right. one change and does it again. And he keeps doing that and it keeps getting better and better. And mind you, he's gotten it close and he's just finally tuning it in. And then of course, about the time he gets it perfectly set up for one course, then they go race Crandon and then they go race Hammers and then they go race Moab. What we just saw in the past month, how amazing times it is for Ultra 4 when we're talking about cars that are built to be able to do anything. They raced Crandon. That's a short course. I mean, that is dirt, short course, backing it into corners, wide open. You know, I mean, that's a place where you're going to pop a motor. You're going to pop a motor. That's where you're going to do it at because yeah. you're wide open throttle. And you went from there and 2 weeks later, 14 days, you're racing Moab. And it's rocks and ledges. And the stories I heard came out of there were guys saying they were more sore after 8 laps at Moab than they were after an entire day racing King of the Hammers and the 44 on the Friday race. So
it looked brutal.
And flat tires and rock ledges and up and down and 40 miles of nuisance rocks. And yeah, it's hard to set a car up.
I mean, Ultra 4 is some of the most versatile stuff on the planet if you want to do it quickly. There's lots of vehicles that would get the same job done, maybe not in a hurry, though. So,
yeah, Suzuki Samurai.
Yeah.
Stop. I mean, 31s.
yeah. I mean, you'll get a lot done for sure. It ain't going to be the same day, but.
No, right. But I think that's it. Yeah. So when you asked me about, you know, having like Paul Horschel, I mean, Paul Horschel's mind. I don't know Paul, but I do really appreciate and value what goes on in his mind and his way of thinking and his way of developing a car, then executing the build of the car and then how he drives. He's certainly an impressive individual that I would be remiss if I didn't have him on a list to talk to.
When the Dos Equis guy passes away, I think Paul should probably be that guy, the most interesting man in the world.
Definitely Ultra 4 right now. Just well, because people are curious about something they don't know, right?
Right.
And sure. Paul doesn't talk.
So, right.
I think that's pretty cool. Well, you answered, you know, every question I had to throw at you today, Phil. I'm sorry to our listeners for our technical difficulties and us not figuring out how to make this happen. That we're watching each other, you know, my normal standard Skype record, except for it's muted, and we're actually just on cell phones. Recording what the cell phones say, but did we cover everything you want to talk about? Was there anything that was left unsaid that you'd like to get off your chest and air out there? Or
I can't think of anything, man. I mean, that was, you know, it's your show for sure. I'm just here to answer questions.
You answered a lot of them, man. Awesome. Cause I think it takes a lot to get somebody to agree to talk about themselves for an hour and a half. I mean, that's hard. So thank you for doing that.
Anytime, man.
Yeah. Well, everybody, Phil Licardi, Liberty Mountain Fab, yep, Shock Jesus. We never even went into how he got that name, really, but I think it was just a picture. I think it was awesome.
Justin Hall's fault.
Yeah. Hey, everybody. Phil, thank you for coming on. Appreciate you.
Glad to be here. Thank you.
All right, everybody. We are out. Catch you next week.
Thank you for listening and taking a dive into the Talent Tank. Please like and subscribe on Instagram @The Talent Tank or our website, thetalenttank.com.